I'm not impervious to emotion. I'm just like anybody else. I might have been in the business and I might have gone through a lot of things and been more trained in a way to respond a certain way, but it was a trying time for me and my family, as well as my client.
Welcome to the Free From Wall Street podcast, where we share how we have done over $200 million in real estate deals to create, preserve, and pass on generational wealth without the roller coaster ride of the stock market. If you're ready to start investing with purpose, visit freefromwallstreet.com. But for now, let's dive into this episode.
Welcome back to the Free From Wall Street podcast. Listeners, today we're introducing you to the newest team member of IHG, Mr. Chris Krauser. Chris, thanks for being on, man.
Thanks, Steve. Happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. So we want to just kind of share with the listeners a little bit about your background, where you came from. And then I think it's a fun story, just kind of how we met and, like, you know, over the years, how it ended up that you would finally come and work with us. So why don't you give folks a little bit of background in terms of, like, what your career path was in the past?
Sounds good. I appreciate it. Yeah, I started out going to school at Clemson, was a marine biology major, learned real quickly I couldn't do chemistry. My father quickly guided me back on track and said, why don't you go into financial management and just do marine biology as a hobby. So I took his advice and I majored in financial management, moved back up to New York City, where I worked at US Trust and Morgan Stanley Trust for about 7 years after college, got all my designations that I needed to get to be in the industry and be an advisor. And then I don't know, around 2005, my wife and I just were getting kind of burnt out on commuting in and out of the city and just the people and the crowds. We wanted something a little different. So we moved down to Florida. And I teamed up with a business partner down there in Florida, or down here in Vero Beach, Florida. And we had about another 7 year run where things went fairly well for the first 4 years or 3 years. And then, as we remember, the Great Recession 2008 occurred and it kind of upended us. And we tried to rebuild for a few years and it just turned out that it was too much as a partnership for us to handle. So I decided to move over to Fidelity Investments and I was an advisor there with both their branch system as well as their private wealth management division up until this past year. It was a great run, about 24 years in total, I think, somewhere in that range in the financial services industry. And there were some obviously very good moments and some very, very trying, troubling, frustrating, exhausting moments as well.
And so when you say financial services industry, tell the listeners what that is. Is that like stocks, bonds, mutual funds? Like what were the typical things that you were planning with your clients and directing them into?
Yeah, that's a good question. I did comprehensive wealth and estate planning with my clients. So when you think about, you have two sides. You have investment planning, which includes traditional stocks and bonds, international, domestic, large cap, small cap, growth, value. Then you also have the estate planning side where you have life insurance policies, you have trusts and estates that are being drafted by attorneys. I'm working with attorneys and their clients and trying to make the two of those things mesh, make sure that one is not competing with the other, that they're sort of symbiotic in a way. And so I loved it as far as in theory, what that meant. I loved the relationship I had with my clients. I loved the idea of helping them achieve those goals. And there was, again, some great years that we were doing some great work. There were some frustrating moments just from a Fidelity, who I love. I'm not going to say anything bad about them. They're a great firm to work for during the 10 years that I worked with them. But it became a little bit more of a triage feeling that I was having rather than a proactive feeling. And so I guess 5-6 years ago, I started hearing from my clients that they were looking into passive income. They are hearing about it from their neighbors, from their friends, and hearing about private equity investments and venture capital funds and that type of stuff. And at the time, we really didn't offer anything like that. And it just so happened that I was on an airplane and I was flying back from New Jersey and I was sitting next to these two guys who were very excited about something. And it just happened to be you and Travis.
And we were having a good time. We were so excited, right? It was our first commercial deal. And yeah, we just happened to sit next to you and your family flying back from Jersey. We're coming down to Orlando to see our first commercial project, right? We're house flippers from Jersey that are now doing this like large scale. This was our first storage facility that we were building ground up, and we were going to put eyes on the dirt for the first time. So all we were doing is going to check out 12 acres of dirt on Osceola Polk Line Road in Orlando. And we just strike up a conversation, right? And I'm like, so what do you do? What do you do? And yeah, so we were excited.
I could sense your excitement, obviously, and it was infectious. It caused me to look deeper into what you guys were doing after you explained what it is that you guys do. And so over the next, you know, we stayed in touch, which was, I think, a good, you know, we obviously left that plane ride feeling there was a connection there. And so
what you guys don't know is that him and Travis are talking about, like, their brother, like Chris's brother would surf with Travis up in Bricktown, New Jersey. And like our business, if you guys haven't heard the story, was born on the beaches of Costa Rica. Travis and I decided in Costa Rica to like burn the boats and, you know, stop working for other people, and came back from Costa Rica and decided to start IHG. You know, so Chris has connection to Costa Rica too, though his family's been out there a bunch, and you used to have a house there, right?
We had a house in Panama. Yep. So it was all, again, surfing was the common denominator, I guess, when we were talking, and that kind of led us into the business discussions, which led us into staying in touch, which led me into, you know, led me further down the road into exploring and learning about the commercial income producing property industry. And so, yeah, it was exciting. I left there and my wife thought I was crazy. My kids thought I was crazy because I was clearly having a good time talking to you guys. And they said, you just talk to everybody. You can't help yourself. You just get on an airplane. And I said, no, these are two guys I felt like I was meant to meet. And so, and they were laughing, but I think they, you know, ultimately understand it now.
Yeah. Well, and then fast forward 4 years later, and I'm inviting you and your wife to come up and meet with us and talk logistics about where you wanted to go career-wise and like what it is that we offered. And, you know, we really started digging into kind of the nuts and bolts of the business. And, you know, so for me, what I thought was the most interesting piece of it was that you've been in financial services for 20 years by the time we met and didn't have something to fulfill that desire for some of those clients. And that's all we knew, right? I don't have a single dollar in stocks and bonds. If you've listened to the podcast, you've heard the story of the downturn eating up half of my dad's retirement before him passing away, and he didn't get to ride it back up. And, you know, so I'm always intrigued by that side of the market because I know that that's where the majority of wealth is stored in this country. And that's what we're taught to do, right? We're taught to go to school, get a good job, and put it in a retirement account with mutual funds and stocks and bonds. And that's fine. Like I know most of my friends do that. And as we started talking about real estate, right, we were talking about the types of returns that we're offering to our clients and the tax benefits and things like that. And I just saw such a synergy there. And for those of you that don't know, the first thing I asked Chris was like, well, how do we work together? Right? Like, how can I work with you at Fidelity and offer something inside their portfolio that they might want? And what's the answer to that, Chris?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different answers, to be honest with you. But the big one to me was, I think it comes down to my clients for the longest time, every time we had a big upswing in the market, they would ask me how excited I was about these great returns that we were getting 20, 25, 30% a year. And you get a couple of those years in a row of 20+%. And my answer back to them was, I'm not excited at all. This makes me extremely nervous. The more we outpace the historical returns of the market consistently year over year, the greater the odds of a massive downturn or some downturn that will occur in the future. And if you look back in history, that's essentially what happens. The market is on a pendulum and you get overheated. And the more it overheats, the more likely it is to snap back the other way. And then on the other side, it oversells and then it snaps back the other way. And that is fine for the investor that has ice in their veins and that they don't have emotions about the market. They don't have emotions about their investments. I would say the majority of investors out there aren't that. Right? The majority of investors out there do have emotions. And for that reason, liquidity is a blessing and a curse.
Yeah. So what you're talking about is volatility in the market, right? And people get excited about upswings and then they get depressed and emotional about downswings. But that's kind of the nature of the market, right? I mean, like, and I'm curious to know kind of how you dealt with clients' emotions during those times. Like, I mean, it's a long game, right? Playing the stock market over time. And like, you can't get emotional on a day-to-day basis, but you know, let's talk about the recession, right? I mean, what happened in 2007, 2008, when we saw that bigger downturn? Like, how did you keep people calm? What was their feedback? Like, what were you experiencing on that side of like kind of the wealth management?
Yeah, I mean, it was, again, go back to triage. There was calls coming in all day long. I was answering as many calls as I could, making dial backs. It was long days. And then you go home at the end of the night and you're trying to rationalize everything that's going on and trying to try to feel good about what you're telling your clients and also practicing what you preach, right? So I'm not impervious to emotion. I'm just like anybody else. I might have been in the business and I might have gone through a lot of things and been more trained in a way to respond a certain way, but it was a trying time for me and my family as well as my clients. So it's not as easy as just saying, don't sell, ride it out. It's okay. I mean, everybody's situation is different, right? Depends on age, need, a variety of different things. And so I definitely remember those times very well. I was 100% commissions at the time when that was happening. That was not the most fun thing to be in when everybody's selling out and you can't get people to stop reacting to their emotions. And you also are trying not to react to your own emotions. It was about the hardest time in anybody's career, or at least in my career, that I can imagine having. And so for that reason, I never want to go through that. I never want to put my family through that again. I want consistency of income, consistency of growth, as much as I can possibly make it, and try to be as tax advantaged as I possibly can as well. And so for all three of those things, our conversations just seemed to resonate with me so well. And I just knew that it was something that I needed to get that word out to the people that I knew that I've been working with over the last 24 years.
Yeah. So we meet on this plane. We're going to build our first storage facility, which we took about $4 million in depreciation that year, by the way. I think it was 2 years later that I sent Chris a picture of my tax return. And I said, we should probably talk. And it was like negative 400 grand. And he was like, yeah, I think we should probably talk. And, you know, so we just kept in touch. And before, when I was asking like, how do we work together? What I meant to bring up was the fact that there is really no way for private real estate investors like ourselves to work with these big shops, like a Wells Fargo or Fidelity or, you know, these private wealth management groups. They have an amazing array of products they can offer, but to get listed in or work with those types of shops, they need to know how to manage it properly, right? They need to be able to offer it and they need to make money off of it, which makes sense. There's not a lot of places that you can go to get anything outside of a REIT, right? You can get a real estate investment trust, you can lock up your money for a certain period of time, and you can probably get 6 or 7, maybe 8% outsized returns, right? But to go somewhere and to get the double digit returns that we talk about, the pass-through tax benefits, and you know, just some of the other passivity in terms of income production, like there's not a lot of that out there. And I can't just go to Wells Fargo and say, hey guys, put me on your platform and tell all your clients about me. It's just not how it works, right? And just so you listeners that don't know this, is why doesn't my financial advisor tell me about this stuff? Frankly, he can't, right? It's called selling away. You could actually put your licensing in jeopardy. So talk a little bit about that and just what is selling away. And not to say that financial services guys are handcuffed, but they're limited in terms of what they are allowed to tell clients because they can only offer certain things, right?
Yeah, there's definitely that danger of selling away if the firm finds out that you are, even though if you believe that it's the right thing for the client, if you're telling them about something that that firm doesn't offer, obviously the firm doesn't like that, right? They're not going to make revenue on a piece of the pie, if you will, that's not sitting with their firm or not connected to their firm in some way. And so they will push other products that they do have a connection with that might have a loose ability to produce income and growth, but generally it's not consistent. Generally it's not as, in terms of the total package, it's not as appealing. And not to mention, it's not transparent, and it's not tax advantaged. So there's a variety of reasons why the things that they do have that are income producing or growth producing or a combination of both, they're just sort of, I don't know, they're weak when you look at it relative to some of the private equity investments that are out there, particularly in income producing commercial real estate.
Yeah. And that was kind of, I think, what, you know, initially spawned your interest. And then we just continued to have more and more conversations, right? About, you know, hey, check out this book, Tax-Free Wealth. Read this or listen to this podcast about commercial real estate investing. And I think you started to open your eyes to the fact that there was another piece of this world, right, that even existed, because you were in that industry for so long, but didn't see a lot of what we were doing.
We'd always been told that real estate, and again, the things that I've been told about real estate were specific to residential, was not specific to commercial. But if you were thinking about buying and owning homes over the long term, the things that people were not taking into account when they looked at their bottom line returns were taxes, or that you're paying on the real estate, or maintenance on the real estate, or insurance on the real estate. And when you back all those things out, the return over the long run from a single property that you own that you would otherwise given up stock investments and put it into that, we were always told that the investment's not appealing relative to the stock market, right? And so I didn't know that this other side existed, that it seems crazy to me in hindsight that I never opened my eyes to commercial real estate and how broad it is. I mean, there are a variety of different areas you can go within commercial real estate, right? And there's apartments, you know, senior housing, storage, student housing, like we participate in. And then there's the big New York style high rises, you know, where it's office space. And you know, I you don't know what you don't know, but then once you do open you open yourself up to learning something new, and you dive in and really get to know it, that's when I think my whole outlook on it changed, my whole perspective changed. And honestly, it gave me a reason to think outside the box other than stocks and bonds going from that point forward. And I'm not saying stocks and bonds are bad. I'm not. I've got my own investments that are still in stocks and bonds, but it's also now a portion of it. It will be going towards what we do on the commercial real estate side. And I see it as a great diversifier. It's got a great history in recessions. If you look at what this particular industry, you know, has done over the last, you know, whatever it is, through the last great recession. And so I'm excited about always having that one thing that's doing well when times are tough. And one thing that's sort of, I call it the buoy on the portfolio, right? You always need to have something that's floating the portfolio. And that this, to me, at least historically speaking, it looks like it could be that component.
Yeah. And I think that that's a lot of people's view on real estate too, is they know what they know, which is residential real estate. So they're looking at their houses, they're looking at neighborhoods, they're looking at maybe single family or duplex rentals, right? But I think overwhelmingly, it's a blind spot for people that when they pass that 300 unit apartment complex, that somebody owns that and that they're producing revenue from it, and that it's an investable asset and it's a tangible asset and it's not correlated to the market. And then you start to look deeper, and you know, this is what people always talk to me, because I, you know, we tout, especially on Free From Wall Street, about the market volatility. There's just inherent volatility in the market. When you lose 20% of your portfolio, you have to make 25% back of what's existing to get back to even, right? So there is a cost to volatility. And then, you know, overwhelmingly we hear the same thing. Well, Steve, real estate is volatile as well, right? Look at what happened in 2007, 2008. And you said the same thing when we first started having the conversation. And it is, well, look, not all real estate is created equal, right? The 2007, 2008 crash, there was a 7% mortgage default rate in this country that basically predicated the entire financial collapse. And during that same time frame, and this is, you can look this up, we'll put it in the show notes, 0.4% of multifamily was in default. 0.4%. So
what's the big difference between, go ahead, I'm sorry.
What's the
big difference between residential and commercial? The multifamily is the cash flow, right? The cash flow is what keeps that investment moving in the right direction. And I can understand back then, you know, they're giving mortgages to anybody and everybody. I can tell my own story about this. This was crazy. I moved to Vero Beach, Florida with my wife. We had both quit our jobs. We hadn't even started working yet down there. And we went to the mortgage broker and we said, hey, we need a mortgage. And they said, okay, how much money did you make last year? And we told them, and they didn't ask for proof of employment. They just gave us a mortgage to buy a house. So it's no wonder. Now, again, we didn't default, but I think a lot of people were doing the same thing with no money and no income, and they defaulted, of course. But you can, in hindsight, I'm like, holy cow, that should have been a red flag that they gave me a mortgage to buy a house that was fairly substantial in value with no proof of current income. I mean, that's unbelievable.
The ninja loan, right? The no income, no job, no asset, ninja loan. And I mean, if you guys haven't watched The Big Short or read The Big Short, like obviously it's a great, it's a good movie about kind of how the financial collapse took place. But the, you know, when you're comparing residential real estate and commercial real estate, it's important to understand that, you know, the cash flow of these 100 unit, 200 unit buildings from renters are floating that mortgage, right? It's shocking to people when they find out that we buy a $50 million building and it's a non-recourse loan, right? Like you, when you have to sign on your house, you personally guarantee that loan, which means it's a recourse, meaning there's a recourse if you don't pay, which is they'll take your house back. These assets get underwritten by these banks and they allow, like Travis and I have to sign on the debt, but it's non-recourse, meaning unless I do something illegal, right? Unless I do something that's what they call a bad actor in terms of like how you're managing the asset, then there's no recourse if you miss that loan. Why? Because Fannie and Freddie Mac, they know that these assets are very stable in their portfolio. They'll give me 80% loan to value and not make me personally guarantee that. Well, that's crazy, right? But that's because the asset is so strong, the cash flow is there. They underwrite to the asset, not to me personally. And that is a big, I think, eye-opening fact for a lot of people. And then they start to look at, okay, so I get cash flow, I get tax benefits, I get these other things. And I mean, we have hundreds of investors now. And if I had a nickel for every time somebody said, I can't believe I didn't know about this before, I'd be a wealthy man. Like it's just not something that's taught, that's talked about. It's not usually a piece of people's portfolios in terms of like retirement planning. And I think that's, you know, that's why we have a podcast. It's why we're inviting people to go join the investor club. But, you know, I love the take. I love the fact that the podcast is free from Wall Street and you are now free from Wall Street.
Yeah, absolutely. It's exciting. It's nerve-wracking in a way. I mean, after you spend a quarter century or almost a quarter century doing one thing, and now I'm taking a, you know, a left-hand turn into something a little bit different. But I think I want to touch on one word that you used, which I like, is, you know, or maybe it's a hyphenated word, non-correlated, right? So people, when they tell me, when I was an advisor in the traditional financial services world and for stocks and bonds, they would say, oh, I'm diversified. I've got Tesla, Apple, Google, Netflix, Amazon, Facebook. You know, I've got them all. And I'm like, well, okay, that's all one industry. That's all the tech sector. So that's not diversified. And then they would be like, oh, well, I also have, you know, small cap stocks and large cap stocks, and I've got some international. And I'm like, okay, but there's still a fair amount of correlation between all of those asset classes. One might outperform the other in a good market, and one might outperform the other in a bad market, but generally they're all going down in bad markets. They're all going up in good markets, just which one is doing the best.
Yeah. And the market's frothy now, right? And it has been over the last couple of years. So, I mean, I think everybody's kind of waiting for the shoe to drop, and whether that's going to be inflation or interest rate hikes and how that correlates to the market, we'll see. What I like specifically about these asset classes is the level of control we have. So when you go into these funds, small cap, large cap, like you go into a fund or you go into a stock, you're not in the day to day. You're investing into a board seat essentially as a shareholder. And, you know, you're getting told why the company is doing better or why it's doing worse. And that typically drives the price of the stock up or down. But frankly, a tweet can make a stock go up and down.
Elon Musk.
Right. I mean, so, you know, Elon bought Twitter today, right? Or yesterday. And, you know, it's finalized, whatever. And, you know, there's this whole big, like, well, what's going to happen and all this stuff. But yeah, I mean, when Trump would tweet something and a stock would go up or down, or Elon will text something and the stock would go up or down. My understanding, and you know, you can shed some light on this just based on your experience, but my understanding was that typically stocks would go up or down based on quarterly reports and earnings, mm-hmm. right? And how well a company was doing. That is not the case anymore, right? Like it goes up or down and there's really no rhyme or reason to it. And so you were saying that's what you like about this real estate game too, is like you like the idea of the control that we have over each asset class.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that the control is something that I thought about this morning, and just the fact that we can, when we're underwriting this, if we have control of, is this a property that we want to pursue? And let's put the different variables into the underwriting, you know, put up the different figures in there, and let's see what churns out, and let's stress test it. And let's make sure that in any condition, any interest rate condition, any inflationary condition, that we're going to be okay. And, you know, and let's assume different variables and make sure that this is going to check out. And if all the boxes check, we're going, we're moving forward. We're buying the property. Right. And to me, that's control, that there's an element of safety in that. And, you know, again, rather than waiting for a random tweet from Elon Musk saying that he bought Twitter, and just so you know, the old adage is buy on rumor, sell on news, right? So when you hear the rumor, you buy. When you see the news, you're like, oh, it's time to sell. Yeah. and most investors, unfortunately, they just don't operate that way. And that's, again, going back to institutional investing versus retail investing. Retail investors are always the last to find out everything, basically. So it's a really tough game to play. Sometimes you can get lucky for a while, but to do it consistently, it's very difficult. If you're buying and selling your own stocks or buying and selling your own investments.
Yeah. So, and what I like about commercial real estate specifically is that the valuation of a property is predicated on the net operating income. And it's not, you know, so essentially earnings, right? It's net operating income. There's income and expenses on every property. After you subtract the expenses out of the income, then you come up with the net operating income. And that's controllable when we go into a property. So when we're looking and underwriting at a property and we're saying, okay, so this 300 unit complex is 15% adjusted, like 15% of those units are adjusted to market rents, but the other 265 units are not adjusted to market rents yet. And they're under market by, you know, $100, $120 a month per unit. We know that this is how we can raise the value of this project over the next, you know, 3, 5, 7 years, depending on what the plan is on how to turn that. So I like it because I'm not, you know, the stock market to me, and, you know, obviously not dogging your previous profession. I think that there's a lot of smart people in that profession, but I never understood it. And I always felt like I was taking a gamble whenever I would buy anything. Like it wasn't predictable, right? In so much that I knew that in 10 years I would make this much money. In real estate, I do. Like I know how much we're going to make in the next 5 years between cash flow and exit valuation based on net operating income. And there's only two ways to make money in this business, and that's to increase rents and decrease expenses. And we know very well how to do that across the portfolio. And that to me gives me a certain level of certainty, right? I mean, obviously any investment has risk, but when you sit down, you underwrite, you look at the factors, right? Like when we bought that 384 units in Daytona Beach, we knew that there was $45 per month that we could increase rents in 300 of the units, because 84 of the units had washers and dryers in the unit, and we were getting a $45 rent bump on those units. And now all we had to do was put washers and dryers in the rest, then we would make another $560 a month, or $560 a year per unit times 300 units times whatever the cap rate is. So we knew how much value we could create over time. And that's what I like about the real estate industry in general, is if you're underwriting to good assumptions and you know what market rents are going for, and you're seeing where populations are moving, and you're seeing that there's a shortage of housing, then you could reasonably expect that those rent bumps will take place.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it any better. I think you hit the nail on the head. And, you know, there's controls in place. And let's suppose we do all those numbers and we don't see the ability to raise rents, or we don't see the demographics moving into that territory. We're obviously not going to move forward, right? We do the underwriting. We've done that many times. I know you've gone through the whole underwriting process. You're excited about a property. the numbers just don't check out. They just don't, unfortunately. Well,
that's it.
You got to put your emotions aside.
Yeah.
You get rid of a property that you were excited about, but the numbers speak for themselves and you say, okay, let's move on. Let's find another property that may be a better suited investment.
Yeah, we just had it happen last week where, you know, a good friend of mine who's an operator called us up and he wanted our fund to bring the equity to the deal. And we knew what our strike price was. And he sent us the underwriting and he said, well, the guy came back and he gave it, you know, it was 48 million. And we were at like 46 million. And he was like, all right, so they countered at 48. And I was like, that's just too high. Like, it just doesn't work. The numbers don't work at that number. And right. You would think that you're only talking about 1% of the purchase price.
Right. It sounds like it's easily made up for, but
yeah, I think I can make that work. But that's the thing, right? Is you don't want to make anything work. That's when real estate investors get in trouble, is when they get emotionally attached to a project. I'm emotionally attached to the numbers, right? I don't even need to see an asset anymore. I like to see the drone footage and I like to see the photos, but I want to see the model. I want to see the underwriting Excel model where we're looking at sensitivities across all of these things. And when it checks all those boxes, then I get emotional about the deal. I'm like, oh man, this is a good deal because the numbers are good.
Right.
But yeah, you can't get emotional about the deal itself until the numbers make sense. And if you're underwriting conservatively, right, which everybody claims to do, then you'll keep yourself in a pretty safe position by not overextending or over leveraging or doing any number of those things. So let's see. I know we want to touch on a couple more points here.
I wanted to ask you a quick question. So, you know, we talk a lot about where we buy properties and where we're looking to buy properties. And what's the general consensus in the industry as far as the need, or is there a shortage or is there an abundance of those properties in those areas that we're looking? I mean, I think the numbers are pretty clear, but I want you to speak a little bit to that if you don't mind.
So, I mean, statistically speaking, there's a housing shortage in the United States, especially in areas of population growth. So we like the Sun Belt, right? Every front thing from Texas to Florida and the Southeast and some of the Midwest too. You'll find an investor for everywhere, right? If you wanted to go find somebody buying in New York right now, you'll find people buying in New York City. We don't buy in New York City. We don't buy in California. We don't buy in New Jersey, specifically because overwhelmingly populations are leaving those areas, right? You can look at heat maps. U-Haul actually has a really good one on their website where it just shows where are people moving from and where are they landing. So there's a housing shortage in all of the areas that we're looking to buy. What that makes difficult is that there's a lot of money chasing those areas, right? Orlando, right. Top five growth for the last 5 years in a row.
I believe it.
There's a lot of money chasing those areas because they know that over time it's going to increase in value. So the appreciation is there. So it makes it a very competitive market is my point. So I wouldn't say that there's, you know, I look at the shortage question as, is there a shortage of deals for us to buy? And is there a shortage of where people need to live, right? So from an individual's perspective, there's a shortage, right? And that's why rents are going crazy and through the roof, is because supply and demand. That's how housing works. It's why we're building 100 units right now in Charlotte, right? We're doing build to rents because there's such a shortage of housing and we can see what the area rents are getting that it makes sense now to build. Even in this inflationary period where material costs are up, it still makes sense to build based on what rents we're going to get. So I hope that, does that answer your question?
It definitely does. And, you know, I definitely like the Carolinas. I think there's a lot of, you know, the Tennessee Carolinas. There's a lot of people I know that, you know, a lot are going to the Sun Belt states. There's no doubt, but there are a lot that I know from the Northeast that are simply just going maybe halfway down. So there's maybe the demand isn't as high, but it might be easier to buy a property in those areas because the demand isn't as high. The competition isn't as high for us to find the right property. So no, that's exactly where I thought you would, or how I thought you'd answer that question.
Yeah. I mean, Florida and Texas are blowing up and that's why we love buying property there. Cause over time in the next 10 years, right, the census is telling us where they expect populations to be. And that is a good predictor of where rents will go. So yeah, there's so much to get into in terms of underwriting and demographics and stuff. I really wanted people to understand your story, right? Your background, coming from the financial services industry and, you know, being that we are talking about Wall Street versus real estate all the time, And I've said this before on the show, it's not that we say that's the only way, right? I don't think 100% of your portfolio should be in real estate, although mine is, frankly. Mm-hmm. I think that as a portion of your portfolio, it helps do exactly what you said, which is give you something not market correlated or less market correlated that is a tangible, hard asset that can give you some diversification. I think it's just a big piece of, it should be a piece of everybody's portfolio.
Absolutely. And there's other reasons why I joined Integrity Holdings Group too. I mean, I felt that our core values aligned, right? The values that of the people in my life and the people that, and I also saw how studious you were in the underwriting process when I was talking to Travis and we were up in, you know, at your home there in that area. And we're going through the numbers of one of the projects you were working on and that this is not a fly by the seat of your pants sort of firm. You guys are absolutely, when it's business time, it's time to do business. And you guys really hit, you know, it definitely hit me that small companies can be extremely exciting in this industry if you choose the right group. And I chose you just as much as you chose me, and vice versa, right? We talked to each other. We thought it might work out a couple of years ago. Then all of a sudden we got kind of, things got a little bit off path, and then we came back together again. And I think it was something where I just felt this was the right group at the right time in the right industry that I wanted to get into. And so I am really excited about the future of the company, the future growth of the company, and some of the deals that we're going to be putting together here over the next year or two. It's going to be fantastic. I can't wait.
Yeah, it's cool. And this is the week that we're launching our $100 million equity fund for accredited investors. And it's an exciting time because we know that that equity that we'll bring in from private investors that are looking for passive income and tax benefits is going to directly relate to probably $500 million or so of assets that we're going to acquire over the next couple of years. And you know, it's exciting to us because we're helping our families and our investors create generational wealth, passive income in a way that they haven't been able to do before, right? And giving a lot of money away through our donor advised fund. So, I mean, that is so fun when we jump on these team meetings and we hear, right? I sent you that Voxer of the Toms River Field of Dreams, which their grand opening is this week. And Gavin, who's wheelchair bound after a traumatic brain injury from a car accident since he was 18 months, his dad carried him over the goal line at the Rutgers Stadium, right? And the team's like throwing him up in the air and cheering and whatnot. And like, these are the things that we share internally that are important to us because the deals that we do are funding these types of cool projects. And yeah, I mean, I just think it's so fun. Like, I know that large corporations can do philanthropy as kind of part of their culture, but it's difficult to create that type of culture in a large, trillion dollar business.
It's more personal. It's definitely more personal, right? Because we know the individual players, we know who we're helping, we hear from them, we see them. And that makes it much more personal and exciting from, you know, again, you're going to get me emotional again. After you sent me that little video, it was amazing. But yeah, the last thing that I didn't touch on that I wanted to say was a big part of my appeal towards this industry was the tax advantages. I know you touched on it a little bit earlier, right. But tax advantages are so strong. And a lot of people I know who, again, after the downturn with COVID and everything, the ones that didn't bail out, thankfully, the ones that stayed the course, they made a lot of money. But then if you want to sell those investments from the upswing and you want to use some of those investments for other purposes, you got to sell and there's a big tax hit. And a lot of people that I know, unfortunately, were not so thrilled with their 1099s they got this past year because of all the taxes that they have had to pay. And, so the consistency of the returns, the consistency of the income and the tax advantages can't be, there's no way to overstate it. It's an amazing trifecta of greatness. So
yeah, it's a great tool to use too, especially if you are in the market and you're getting high dividends and you're getting 1099 income, and talk to your CPA, right? We're not accountants, but at least in my life, that passive income, that depreciation goes to offset at least the income that I'm making within the real estate, but also potentially offsetting the dividends that we're getting on 1099s from other investments, right? And then you can go a step further and go into real estate professional status, which is where kind of your mind gets blown in terms of like being able to offset all of your ordinary income too. But for the common investor, right, that's not a real estate investor, that's a W-2 employee working somewhere or a business owner working somewhere, this still has better than I've ever seen tax advantages attached to the type of real asset that you're able to purchase to create passive income. There's a ton of strategies out there where you'll just go and maximize depreciation, but you're effectively taking a loss so that your tax bill is smaller, right? This creates income while creating a loss. It's it's an amazing asset class.
It is, and there's no doubt. And I don't know if it can be, it can't be replicated in traditional stocks and bonds in the same capacity. I know that,
right?
At least not that I know. And again, I'm not an accountant. We always have to defer back to the accountant, but
you can go to the podcast. You can go check out. We've had multiple episodes with our accountants coming on and talking about this, and yeah, make sure that your accountant is understanding this stuff too. Cool. Well, this is a little bit longer than we typically run, Chris, but I wanted to make sure that everybody got in here and was able to meet you and hear your story. Cause I love the fact that, you know, you're a certified financial planner and certified wealth strategist, and you've had all of these licenses and you've been in the Wall Street game for so long, and there was clearly something that made you start looking into it. And as you dug deeper and put more time into understanding the industry, you ripped the Band-Aid off and decided to jump ship. And that's a big move. It's a big life decision. And I think that even for the investor, it's a little bit daunting to try to figure out like, well, what is it that makes this better than something else? And you and your wife and your family went through this process yourself. You're investing in the fund, right? I hope I'm allowed to share that alongside of us, right? Just like we are, because you believe so much in the asset classes. So we put our money where our mouth is as well. And it's, I think it's just such a cool story. So welcome.
Yeah. It felt like a quick decision, but it really wasn't, right? It was 5 or 6 years of staying in touch and hearing more and learning more. And when ultimately you and I and Travis and we got together and started talking more about the details about how this would work together, if we were to try to bring me into the firm, you know, again, that took a couple of months, but it was 5 or 6 years in the making. Once I really got intrigued. Once the intrigue was there, then it was all, it was just a matter of time, I think. But
yeah, for sure. Yeah,
I'm really excited. I am very much excited for the future and to see the growth of the company, the growth of our investors, and also to see what we can do with our donor advised fund and helping other people around the world. It's going to be just an awesome experience. I can't wait.
It is fun. If you guys want to get in touch with Chris, make sure you sign up for our investor club. And once you do, you'll get a link to his Calendly and you can set up a call to talk with him, share your story, pick his brain a little bit about where he's been, where he's going, and how we might be able to potentially work together. So go to integrityhg.com, make sure you sign up for the investor club, and we will check you next time. See you.
Thanks for listening to the Free From Wall Street podcast. If you like what you hear, leave us a rating and review and let us know what you think.